this hour on Behind the Headlines, along with the new year, a new attorney general is sworn in. Attorney Sean Reyes has an impressive resume and a very long to-do list. How long will it take for the new AG to clean house? One of his first orders of business is to defend the state's same-sex marriage ban, Amendment 3. But how will the appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court play out? And it's sunny in the higher elevations, but air quality in Wasatch Front Valleys is downright gross. How does all that pollution affect our health, our quality of life, and the economy? And what solutions are gaining traction? The week's news plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, a new attorney general, an appeal to the Supreme Court, persistent dirty air, and any other stories on your mind. Joining me to talk about the news of the week, Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, who covers state government. And Robert, good morning. Robert.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi.
Good
also morning. With us, Justice reporter Brooke Adams. Brooke, welcome back.
Thank you.
And I guess I've got your wrong microphone on. Okay, Brian Maffley, who covers the environment. Brian, also with us in studio. Brian, hi.
Hi, Jennifer.
And you can join us. What do you think about the new attorney general, general, and what it's going to take to repair that office? How do you think the high court will rule on Utah's appeal of the same-sex marriage ruling? How does the inversion affect you and your loved ones? You can send your questions and comments along to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or put comments on our website at sltrib.com, or you can call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Brooke, I'm going to start with you. A few developments in the same-sex marriage appeal. The state of Utah is asking the U.S. Supreme Court for a temporary stay to judge Shelby's ruling, which clears the way for gay couples to marry in Utah. What's the latest?
Well, today we're waiting for the plaintiffs to file their response to the state's request for a stay. They have until they have another 55 minutes to do that.
55 minutes, okay.
And so any moment that should come, and we'll see what they have to say. You know, they may make some of the same arguments that they've made in previous stay requests from the state. So, but the state changed their tactic a little bit in their...
They're moving their arguments a little
bit.
Yeah,
they are. They're refining them, you might say.
Okay. So they tossed out this idea that procreation should be considered an essential function of marriage.
That's right. They relied heavily on that in their briefs and in their filings before Shelby, and also brought it up again in their stay request to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. But they made a subtle shift when they did their application for a stay to the Supreme Court. They sort of jump over the whole procreation issue and just go straight to child rearing and the best environment for children. So I think that they have sort of looked at, I'm guessing, maybe how the Supreme Court discussed the whole procreation issue in the oral arguments on the Proposition 8 case. Mm-hmm. And there was kind of, frankly, a lot of joking going back and forth between the justices on that issue. So maybe they decided that's not a good place to go.
Not a way to go. Meanwhile, a lot of LGBT couples have been married in the state. How many are all the counties are now complying
right
with the Shelby ruling?
That's correct. And the last count we did, I guess at the end of last week, was that there had been 900 couples had been married. And so I assume that's still going on. And one of the interesting things we were looking at in the last couple of days was whether some people were coming from out of state to be married here. And that does appear to be the case. You know, small numbers of people, you know, we're surrounded by a number of states that don't allow same-sex marriage. And so you might anticipate that people from Nevada or Colorado or Idaho or Arizona might be coming here. And we're getting an indication that small numbers are.
Hmm. Sort of a weird sidebar to this story. An attorney in Salt Lake City has filed a class action lawsuit and named a lesbian couple as one of the plaintiffs. And they say they've never even talked to this guy.
Right. Hopefully that story is closed and over now. Yesterday, the case was closed in the federal court. So what happened there is an attorney had filed a class action lawsuit, which technically isn't considered a class action lawsuit until a judge certifies it as so, for one thing. But he filed this case and he used the names of a lesbian couple who had been married the first days after Judge Shelby's ruling and were featured in a front page story in the Tribune, saw their names, took their names, placed them on his lawsuit as plaintiffs in this class action lawsuit, and they had no idea. Until they were contacted by a Tribune reporter. And they were, you know, understandably not happy because that wasn't their interest in this situation at all.
Coincidentally, one of the couple, one of the women is a lawyer.
That's right. So she, you know, as she told me, luckily she is an attorney, so she knew what to do to try to get their names taken off this lawsuit. And she said she, you know, felt that if somebody else had been named who didn't have her background, it might have been much more difficult for them to go about getting removed. So they immediately contacted this lawyer and tried to get a hold of him to just voluntarily take their names out. When they were unable to do that, they filed the proper paperwork in the court asking that the case be voluntarily dismissed, which as the named plaintiffs, they had the right to do. And yesterday it was terminated and closed. Interestingly, the attorney insisted that under the rules of federal court process, rules of procedure, he did not have to remove their names and that he could use them without their permission. A number of attorneys told me otherwise. So. Mm.
And this attorney, what do we know about him? His name is Mr. Smay?
Yeah, Craig Smay. He's been practicing law here in Utah for quite a while. He's a graduate of the U Law School. He's been in business, I think, since the early 70s. And I really couldn't find much about him. He seems to be a sole practitioner. And he, it appears, does a lot of work in like foreclosure class action, like class action may be his thing.
Hmm. Interesting. Crucial to this story is the parallel news that Utah has a new attorney general, Sean Reyes, taking the oath of office earlier this week. He's a lawyer and a businessman. Robert Gerke, why did the governor say that Reyes was his top pick?
Well, the governor said he wanted somebody who was going to from outside of the office. There are obviously a number of issues that need to be addressed in the office, and the governor felt like somebody from outside the office with a background in a big firm, with, you know, practicing law, was the best direction for him to go. And so that's, given the three picks he had, Brian Tarvin had already worked in the office for about a year, and he felt like Sean Reyes was the better choice. So he comes in with a full plate, as you mentioned, the gay marriage ruling, probably one of the biggest cases in state history, and plenty of existing issues with the setting the office straight.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later. Let's focus on the gay marriage part of this. One of his first orders of business was to send out a request for proposal, an RFP, to find some outside counsel to help the state sort of build the Amendment 3 case. How did he sort of explain this strategy to you, Robert?
Well, I guess the easiest explanation is that the state wants the best people it can have to handle the case, and if those people don't necessarily work in the office, then they'll go out and find them. They acknowledge that that's going to cost some money, you know, that they're going to have to put up possibly a couple million dollars to hire the outside counsel to proceed in this case. They've also been working with this attorney out of Idaho, a man named Bucky Stewart, who's a BYU graduate who had a hand in getting Amendment 3 passed, and Brooke can tell you a little bit more about his background. he's consulting with the state on the case as they're and was on the signed the motion for the stay with the Supreme Court.
Brooke, who's Monty Stewart?
Well, Monty Stewart is the founding president of the Marriage Law Foundation, which is, I guess, a conservative think tank down in Utah County, and as part of the filings in the state case, the Marriage Law Foundation filed an amicus brief or joined with two other law professors in filing an amicus brief before Shelby. Bill Duncan was the participant in that. So he's been a longtime advocate for traditional man-woman, quote, marriage, and has participated in cases in about 9 states across the country, actually. So he's well-versed in this whole debate across the country, and you can tell a subtle change, too, in his hand in the stay application they made to the Supreme Court, I think.
But not a surprise that the state of Utah, the Attorney General's office, would reach out to him.
No, because according to the AG's office, he's been helping them all along, sort of helping them craft their legal theory and approach to this issue.
Okay, again, tell us again, what is happening this morning?
We're waiting for the respondents, the plaintiffs who brought the challenge to Amendment 3 to file their response to the state's request for a stay to the Supreme Court. And maybe I could explain a little bit about that process.
Sure, yeah.
So each justice on the Supreme Court is assigned a circuit Court of Appeals to oversee. Ours happens to be Justice Sonia Sotomayor. So the application for the stay goes to her, and she has some options. She can either handle it herself, or she can refer it to the whole court to decide. If she decides to handle it herself, and whatever decision she makes, whether to grant a stay or to deny a stay, the loser could then ask the next justice in line to reconsider it. And by tradition, if that were to happen, that justice will refer it to the whole court to decide. So there's, as I understand it, there's no time frame here for her to make a decision or the court to make a decision. It could come immediately in a day, could be a matter of days, could be a little longer than that. And in some cases, when it's quite controversial, you may get some written opinions with it. So it's going to be very, very interesting. The legal experts that I've spoken with about it are predicting that she will not grant it. So we'll see how good they are at guesswork.
Mm-hmm. And remind our listeners, just briefly, what the Supreme Court ruled in the Defense of Marriage Act and the Prop 8 case, which came out down last summer. I mean, I imagine that in shaping the arguments, both the plaintiffs and the state are trying to ferret out exactly what the court's intent was in those cases, because it has a direct bearing on the Utah case.
Right. So both sides really drew heavily from the United States versus Windsor case, which was a case out of New York, which struck down, the justices ruled in favor of the Windsor in that matter, and struck down a section of the Defense of Marriage Act. And the issues are different in each of these cases compared to the Utah situation. But basically, why the state is looking at the Windsor case is because the Defense of Marriage Act denied federal benefits to couples in states that sanctioned gay marriage. So they said that was an unfair intrusion of federal authority into what a state had decided about same-sex marriage. That's why the state's looking at that ruling, saying this bolsters our argument that it's up to states to decide and define marriage. And the Proposition 8 case was a little different, because the issue really, first issue that was at hand there, was whether the citizens group who was trying to challenge the federal judge's ruling had standing. The authorities in California, the AG and the governor, decided not to appeal the federal judge's ruling overturning Proposition 8, which would have banned same-sex marriage. So the issue was standing there, and they decided, after hearing oral arguments in that case, not to rule on it, and not to, you know, to essentially say they did not have standing to bring a challenge. So, you know, but in their oral arguments in the Proposition 8 case, there was a lot of talk about the merits of the case and the issue and states' rights. And in fact, there's a reference at one point to Utah saying, yeah, but so in California, one thing they've done differently than Utah is they had granted everything but marriage. They had civil unions approved. They allowed benefits. They allowed medical directives. They allowed gay couples to adopt. Utah does not do that. So the question that they justice is asked at one point was, well, what about a state like Utah that's allowed none of these permissions? Mm. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Absolutely. Robert Gerke, Sean Reyes says he's assembling a transition team. He's going to clean up the culture in the Attorney General's office. Who's on this team and what's on the agenda in that regard?
Well, right now he's brought in former Congresswoman Enid Nicholson, formerly Enid Green, Walholtz, and State Senator John Valentine to sort of lead the transition team. He said there will be others added to it over the coming weeks. And he sort of staked out a few top priorities. I mean, one of the things he wants to do is bring in an auditor to do a financial and administrative audit to make sure that their procedures and policies are in place to kind of, you know, for the office to function smoothly. They are not on the job yet, but I guess he's talked to a few firms that are willing to do it. He's also said he's going to completely overhaul, sort of revamp the division chiefs, you know, ask for everybody's resignation from their post as a division chief and make them reapply for their jobs so he can kind of sort of restructure the entire, you know, leadership team at the AG's office. He's keeping Brian Tarbert on, who's the you know, Chief Deputy Attorney General. He's agreed to stay on through the transition as well. So you know, he's kind of got to hit the ground running. He's got about 11 months basically until the next election. So there's a fairly short turnaround on some of the stuff. And this is also, you know, without a doubt, is an office that's been sort of under a cloud for the last 11 months. And then both the governor and Sean Reyes in their speeches at Sean's inauguration referred to the fact that they need to restore the public trust in the office. And so it's a tall order for him at this point.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW, speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Brooke Adams, and Brian Mathley. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Brooke, as you were talking, so now we have almost 900 some odd LGBT couples who are legally married here in Utah. So obviously they're watching this case very closely as it's assessed by the U.S. Supreme Court. But I mean, what happens now in terms of taxes, in terms of adoption that you mentioned, medical directives, things like that?
Well, one thing Governor Herbert did in the wake of the ruling was he asked each department to tell him how they would be affected now that same-sex marriage is allowed in the state. And some departments have said no effect, really. It's business as usual. I did speak earlier in the week to the spokesperson for the DCFS, the Division of Child and Family Services, because, you know, I was curious about what's the status of being foster parents or
sure.
adoption from state custody. My sense is that private adoptions, couples are free to go pursue those now in Utah if they'd like to. But I think that may be an area to watch what happens there. I was told they were doing a legal analysis to try to determine where that issue stood. But I think it's sort of no change, really, that these departments and agencies have to comply with the federal order. It's the law now in Utah, so it's business as usual.
And Robert, on the legislative side, are you hearing lawmakers grumbling, you know, drumming the battle drums,
yeah.
and sort of looking ahead as the session is starting in just a number of weeks?
Right. Well, it is, I think, there are some who are looking at what they can do to sort of bolster the Utah's opposition to same-sex marriage. One of the things that's being talked about is Representative Jacob Andrick, who is looking at running a constitutional amendment that would essentially just clarify that, you know, churches don't have to perform gay marriages if it's against their faith. There's not been any discussion of that. I don't think it's occurred anywhere in the country, but there is also, you know, sort of a companion piece of legislation at the federal level that would protect churches from being compelled to perform marriages for people that they don't necessarily believe they should have to marry. So that's one of the first things out of the gate. I suspect there will be others, but we haven't seen actual legislation yet on how they're going to approach those topics.
As we've been talking, Brooke, you've been monitoring Twitter. What's going on?
Well, I just wanted to chime in and follow up on what Robert just said. One of the things that Judge Shelby said specifically in his decision, he said that although the state had not brought up the issue of religious freedom, that his ruling did not affect what happened in churches. It had no mandate, no change, and churches were free to continue to follow their policy and practices as far as same-sex marriage. And so in the LDS Church's case, if they're opposed to that, it affects them in no way. They can continue down that line. He said that he considered it to be perhaps an expansion of religious freedom because some churches that wanted to perform same-sex marriages now could in Utah. So I just wanted to make that point.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting that one of the support people who said they would support this proposed protection for religions is State Senator Jim DeBacchus, who also happened to be one of the first couples in Salt Lake to get married after Judge Shelby's ruling.
Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, Brooke Adams, and Brian Mathley is also with us. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Brooke Adams, Robert Gerke, and Brian Mathley. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the new John Swallow subpoenas or gay marriage in Utah or air quality along the Wasatch Front or any other story on your mind, you can give us a call at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can put comments on our page at sltrib.com. Brooke, I know you need to get off to cover this story on the Supreme Court's consideration of the stay. What exactly are the factors that they have to consider to grant a stay?
Okay. You know, as I mentioned, Justice Sotomayor can do it, grant it or decide the issue on her own or refer it to the whole court. If it goes to the whole court, five justices have to agree to grant the stay. And they're going to be doing that based on four criteria. First of all, the first criteria is if this case were to come back before them on a writ for them to hear the full-blown case, is it likely that four justices would grant that a hearing. Hmm. Secondly, they have to decide whether there's a, quote, fair prospect that a majority would reverse the lower court decision. So if it comes before them, is the state likely to prevail? Third, they look at whether there's irreparable harm if a stay is denied, and that is the issue that the state's been trying to bring up, that there's irreparable harm going on in the fact that some couples are being married and their marriages may eventually be invalidated. I'm not sure that's accurate from what I've heard from legal authorities. And they're saying the state's interest is being harmed the longer there is no stay. And then if everything's sort of equal there, then the justices sort of do a balancing act between the state's interests, the applicant's interests, the respondent's interests, and the public interests, and see, you know, how does that all balance out. So that's the calculation that will be going on at the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue.
Okay, so we'll be hearing about that shortly, and Brooke, will let you go so you
Thank
can
you.
Do your reporting. Brooke
Thank
Adams
you.
From the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks a lot. Let's continue on with Well, the embroiled Attorney General's office. Robert, you've had a couple of stories this week. The investigation into misconduct by the former Utah Attorney General, John Swallow, continues. And you reported on a few, I would say, major developments. First, allegations of wrongdoing on Swallow's campaign consultant, Jason Powers. And now investigators want to take a look at his phone and digital records. What's going on there?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that sort of was raised initially, I guess, in the House Investigative Committee's report. Jason Powers had set up these nonprofits, 501c3s, that were created as sort of a shadow campaign account, really, where John Swallow could take money from mostly from payday lending groups that might be politically unpopular, put him in this 501, and then not have to report who gave the money or where the money was going. It's all perfectly legal. It's done at the national level fairly frequently. Then they use this money to put through to other 501s that went to PACs and then would run attack ads against, in this case, John Swallow ran attack ads against Sean Reyes. They also used the money to go after Brad Daw. One of the things that we learned just yesterday in some search warrants that were unsealed by the investigators who are conducting the criminal investigation was that Powers and his campaign staff apparently falsified some tax records, falsified the ledgers that they submitted showing where their money was going. Because under the IRS tax law, you can only use a certain percentage of the money that you raise for political purposes. The rest of it has to go to a sort of public education. That's why they give them the nonprofit status, because these are supposedly, you know, do it out there doing good in the community type groups. So the search warrant, the affidavit supporting the search warrant that the prosecutors wanted, said that according to a confidential source who worked for Jason's consulting company, that they had falsified these ledgers to conceal from the IRS how much they'd actually raised and how much they'd actually spent on political campaigns. So those search warrants were approved by the judge on December 11th. They're actually sealed for 20 days. They were just unsealed yesterday because of the holiday. So there was that one, and there were seven altogether, now bringing a total to 8 search warrants that have been unsealed. There may be more that have not been unsealed, that have been approved and executed, but we just don't know about those yet.
Jason Powers is a pretty interesting character, because if you look at his consulting website, it's his client projects, it's pretty much a who's who of GOP power brokers. We're talking Senator Mike Lee, Senator Orrin Hatch, the governor, Utah Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, Senator John Valentine, on and on. So having him in a central role in the Swallow investigation means something, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Utah's not a huge political pool, and there aren't a lot of political consultants who work in the field, but he is, I think, at the top of the list in terms of, you know, the guy that people would seek out, the guy that clients would seek out to work for. I mean, the list, as you mentioned, is long and it's prestigious, and he gets paid an awful lot of money to do it. So, yeah, I mean, this could have potential far-reaching implications if Jason Powers becomes a target in this investigation, as it appears, you know, that he may be now, according to these search warrants.
You also reported that he apparently directed his staff to delete records, but you say that his lawyer says everything that Powers did was above board.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, these 501s, that's how these operate. These 501s operate in a way that they don't have to disclose their donors, they don't have to disclose their expenditures, you know, the money in and the money out and where they're spending it. The only real requirement is that they spend the percentage, under a certain percentage, on political activities. And so that's where this could become an issue, is if they're spending more on political campaigns and political activities than is allowed by the IRS, they could get into trouble that way. And if they're filing false documents with the IRS to try to conceal that, that's going to be an issue for them too. Mm.
Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet at the hashtag TribTalk, or you can put your comments at sltrib.com. This is a comment on our website from Skier Jim 7. The question is, Steve Reich is still working on the AG's office corruption. Remind us, Steve Reich is the special counsel that was appointed by the House committee. Is that investigation continuing, and is he still on board?
Well, at this point, they're focused mainly on they did the 2 days of presentation that they presented sort of the overview of their findings, and it was pretty amazing stuff. I mean, they went into great detail to sort of lay out their belief that the all of these computers, records, and emails that were that turned up missing, they think it was intentional, and not only that it was done intentionally to try to conceal the email trail, it was done sort of in conjunction with creation of other fake emails or other fake documents to try to, throw investigators off their trail. So right now they've done their presentation on that. They're preparing a written report that we're expecting to come out sometime at the end of the month. There's been discussion among some legislators about whether the state should spend the additional money to let these investigators keep going and find some of these, that there were some leads that obviously they weren't able to pursue to their natural conclusions. And so there was some discussion after the presentation that they should continue doing that. I think that's going to be an issue that legislative leadership is going to have to take up. And if they're going to pursue that further, they're going to have to come up with some additional money. They've already spent about $3 million on it. So it would be another million or $2 to try to let this thing reach its conclusion.
That's part two of Skier Jim's question. Can you name Utah politicians who wish to discontinue the investigation?
Well, I think you mentioned Senator Niederhauser. I think he was one that we quoted after the investigators made their presentation as saying that, the investigation should continue, but it shouldn't be the House to do it. The argument is, obviously, that with John Swallow out of office, having resigned last month, or effective last month, that there's really nothing else the House can do. They can't impeach him. They can't censure him. They can't really do much of anything to him now since he's a private citizen. So now the entity that is in best position to kind of continue the investigation is the criminal prosecutors. We saw Wayne Niederhauser, I think, and Iru said he would, it didn't make sense for it to continue. There will be some who, just logically there's not much the House can do. There are others who say that because this is such a profound importance to the citizens of Utah and the functioning of government that, it's worth letting this thing run its course. Mm. So that's the discussion that's going to be unfolding in the next little while.
Speaking of criminal prosecutors, I saw a tweet yesterday. I think it was either from you or maybe it was from our colleague over at Fox 13, Ben Winslow, quoting Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, that the investigation is at the midpoint. Seriously, we're only halfway through this?
Well, I can tell you what I think about that. I think they're probably trying to alleviate a little bit of pressure. I think clearly, based on what we saw in those search warrant affidavits yesterday, they've done a considerable amount of work. And, this thing has been going on for well over a year since it started. And so it's sort of to think that we've still got a year and a half to 2 years left on this, I don't think is realistic. Not to dispute Sim, he obviously knows more about what the status of his investigation than I do, but I would be surprised if we're talking about this investigation phase 2 years, a year and a half from now. So, it is a long and when you do these investigations, you don't really know when you reach the end until you're there, right? There's always seems to be some other avenue that you need to pursue and leads that you need to pursue, so they can kind of take on a life of their own as well.
Mm. Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, who covers state government, I want to bring in Tribune reporter, environmental reporter, Brian Maffley. And Brian, the evidence that we see outside, it's been soupy for days. We know why the particular matter stays. The shape of our values does not sweep out pollution. But where is pollution coming from? Let's talk about air quality.
Yeah. Oh, it's a subject that gets a lot of, everybody has an opinion on.
Well, what are some of the prevailing theories out there?
Yeah. Well, the State Department of Environmental Quality has attempted to quantify the emissions by source, and they've attributed, they give it a nice precise number, 58%. The pollution comes from vehicles, another 30 from so-called area sources, you know, businesses and homes, and then only 11-12% from big industrial polluters. Now, those are essentially a proxy for their contribution to the particulate pollution we experience on days like we have for the last week. But it's kind of, it's hard to really know, since so much of the pollution we call PM2.5 is actually formed in the atmosphere after it's emitted, and it appears that during inversion events, a larger share, a portion of that fine particulate is becomes this, what they call secondary particulate.
So this is a question that people, scientists, policymakers, everybody's trying to pinpoint exactly where the particulate matter comes from in order to launch prevention.
Exactly, and it's an inherently difficult question to answer because so much of that pollution is basically the emissions from our vehicles and our smokestacks in the form of gases like nitrous dioxide, sulfur dioxide, volatile organic compounds, combining with other stuff that's already in the atmosphere to then form fine particulate. So you can't just pull this stuff out of the air, look at it under a microscope and say, oh, that particle is came from industry and that particle came from a vehicle. It's very difficult to do that. So the state uses these emissions inventories as a rough estimate for the contribution. So they're fairly certain that vehicles play this huge role, 58% of the pollution in general. Now, how much of that during inversion events, I think it's very difficult to say, is it 58% or is it 50% or 60% or?
There is some research showing that smoke, fires, fireplaces, wood stoves contribute a lot.
Isn't that interesting? That was some new research from the University of Utah that is ongoing, and to me, that those findings that wood smoke was a big contributor to particulate pollution, at least direct particulate pollution, the stuff that's actually emitted as PM2.5, really threw into doubt for me the validity of these emissions inventories as a proxy for our particulate pollution. The researchers at the U had kind of found this during inversion, you know, highly polluted days in the winter over the last several winters, a big share, almost 38% of the direct particulate on the filters gathered at these monitoring stations was linked to wood smoke somehow. 38% is from such a small emission source as wood stoves or restaurant grills was kind of a surprise and really kind of opens a lot of new questions about where does our pollution really come from. Developing that further is, well, are the solutions we have, are they appropriate for knocking this problem down? These are all very important questions that I hope that can get answered in the next few years, but we have not really invested all that much into researching this problem, and the state is now making new commitments in that direction.
Hmm. Here's a tweet from Old Man Grimm. Nothing better than biking full time so as not to drive, only to get lung cancer later from pollution. Comment on sltrib.com from North Star. The new AG appealing the gay marriage ruling is stale air. Sort of folding all of our major stories into one Little comment. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley about the air, the stale, stagnant air that all of us are breathing and what we can do about it. Brian, I'm seeing a noticeable number of people wearing masks around town. Does that work?
I just don't know. I have not explored that question yet, and it's worth exploring. But it's also worth noting that the pollution that we're concerned about, PM2.5, is very tiny particles, less than 2.5 microns in diameter, that maybe can penetrate these masks fairly easily. So maybe for the bigger particulate, yeah, but I just don't know for the finer stuff. That's a question we need to explore more. Mm-hmm.
Again, 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can submit comments at sltrib.com, or you can tweet us at the hashtag TribTalk. You wrote this week about a recycling plant, Sims Metal Management. What do they do?
That's right. They are a part of a very large corporation, probably the global leader in recycling metal, which is a great thing for the environment. They have about 170 scrapyards in North America, and what they do is shred metal into smaller pieces that can be easily recycled, but they also take very big pieces that can't be shredded and use torches to cut them into smaller pieces that can then be sent to the mills for reprocessing. And of course, recycling the metal is a great thing for reducing impacts on the landscape and to air quality. Let's just be upfront about that. But when you use torches to cut metal, it puts out a lot of smoke. And it's a small part of Sims' operation, but one that has probably a disproportionate impact on air quality. And so for the last couple years, neighboring businesses to their facility in the west part of Salt Lake City have complained to them and to the Division of Air Quality, saying, you're sending up all this black smoke from your torch-cutting operations. It's coming over our fence and exposing our employees. And the DAQ has monitored the situation. It's perfectly within the scrapyard's permit to do this cutting if they keep the smoke under a certain opacity limit, set at about 15%. What I've got interested in was I've always been trying to challenge this idea that we've tackled all the so-called low-hanging fruit. And if there's, in terms of knocking down particulate emissions, and I just see stuff like smoke coming out of a scrapyard is kind of fairly easy thing to either eliminate or at least time that activity so it doesn't coincide with an inversion. And we put that question to Sims corporate leadership. This is a company that takes great pride in its environmental friendly policies and social responsibility. And when I posed that question to him, why can't you time your use of torch cutting to not coincide with our awful inversions, they really said there is no reason, really, and we're going to stop doing it. We'll stop cutting during high pollution days unless there's some other circumstances that we're going to stop doing that. I think that's an admirable thing for them to do. But still, the type of smoke that comes off the scrapyards is not the kind of stuff that we ought to be seeing in our valley anyway. It'd be nice if they could just capture those emissions. There is technology out there that can be used to capture the emissions, or just not use torches at all. Use industrial shearing equipment. It's probably much more expensive, obviously, but it's emission-free.
Well, as the inversions have lingered on, it's certainly given some ammunition to advocates. I know they're holding a rally later this month at the Capitol. Robert Gerke, I'm just wondering how lawmakers are chiming in on the air quality issue. Are you seeing some bills floating around out there?
Yeah, well, You know, the thing about it is these inversions hit every year about the same time the legislature gears up and the same time the governor's preparing for a State of the State address, and it's impossible really for them to ignore. The governor is thus far, unless Brian has heard more recently than I have, has kind of been advocating that everybody do their part, you know, try to reduce their own individual emissions, but not doing anything from the top down necessarily that would reduce emissions. So I'm sure there will be a discussion of it, and there will be some ideas floated. The legislature in the past has been reluctant to do anything that would, touch on the way businesses operate or people go about their daily lives. You know, that they very conservative state, very limited government, and they don't want to impose mandates on people on how they reduce their emissions. But there is increasing acknowledgement, I think, that what we've got right now is unacceptable and that something more aggressive perhaps needs to be done.
Hmm. Well, certainly this is an issue that is top of mind for many, many Utahns. And I should put a plug in for the Salt Lake Tribune is going to be hosting a public forum, a town hall meeting on Wednesday, January 29th at 7:00 here at the City Library. You can hear it broadcast live on KCPW. We'll be giving you some more details as we get closer to that event. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke here with us. We'll be right back after another quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley, also with us, Robert Gerke. And this tweet it's actually on the comment post at sltrib.com from Utah Soccer Mom. I'm not crazy for another Republican AG, but at this point, I'd settle for a law-abiding Republican AG. Okay, this was an especially heavy news week, particularly because we had a holiday right in the middle. So I am sure that there are stories that have fallen through the cracks, below the radar, whatever metaphor you want to use. Before I let each of you go, we've just got a couple of minutes, but I want to hear from each of you a story that you think got underplayed this week or one that you think will gain traction over time. Brian, let's start with you.
Yeah, this is an environmental story that Brett Prettyman's been following, the mysterious deaths of the bald eagles in our state. I think this story is going to go somewhere because the recent revelation that these eagles were killed by West Nile virus, a disease that we normally associate with the summer months when mosquitoes are active. Here they are afflicting eagles much later in the year. And I'm wondering, what does this say about climate change or other disruptions to environmental processes? It's going to be an interesting one. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how this plays out.
Bald eagles dying. Okay, we're going to look for that story. Robert?
Well, I think it probably hasn't been underplayed, but I think, you know, we had the discussion today about air quality, and I think that's going to be a front burner issue and hopefully not an emitting front burner issue. But, that's going to be a huge issue as the legislature gears up. I think there's also going to be, we're a few weeks away from the beginning of the legislative session. I think there's going to be a big discussion about personal privacy and what people, what protections people have from sort of intrusions into their lives. And it's sort of teed up, I think, by the NSA discussion and other issues that will be emerging in the next few weeks. So watch for that as well.
Okay. My pick, a story about how just 6% out of 270 rape cases in Salt Lake County were actually prosecuted. I think this is going to raise some eyebrows, and we're going to hear more about that. I'm going to leave it there. Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks both for the time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
We're going to wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. He says he's okay with gay marriage, since it means a lot to his friend Rusty.
He was part of the group of guys that I hung around with at the end of high school and just after high school. And everybody in our group sort of understood that he was probably gay, but it wasn't something that he had come out about yet. And I remember the day that he finally decided to tell us, we all laughed at him because we all knew it wasn't that big of a deal to us. But he was the one that I always thought about whenever these gay issues would come up. I just knew that's what he was. And it was not something that he chose.
And it was a touchy topic when Amendment 3 was introduced.
Right. I mean, he was our friend. And so when you're friends, especially if you're guys, you make fun of each other a lot. And so that would come up and he'd make fun of some of us for the things that we'd done or were. And it just went back and forth. But it had never dawned on me that it was a political issue. I just knew about him. And I knew that I wasn't gay. So that was all the thought that I put into it. And then later, as a Mormon, you're sort of expected to get behind legislation that would prohibit it, or at least make them, you know, less equal in the eyes of the law, so to speak. And so I wrote this column about it, explaining the relationship that I had with a gay friend and my own Mormonism, or my own sense of being a Mormon about it.
Well, why don't you read an excerpt? This is a column published in 2004.
Yeah, it was where he asked me if I was going to get behind the amendment in Utah. I said to him, "Wow, I didn't even know you were dating somebody." He said, "I'm not." "Well, then what's the big deal?" This was worth another hour of political harangue that did less to inform than it did to give me a migraine. It was worse than the time I told Bammer's daughter that the importance I placed on the spotted owl was somewhere below that of a ham sandwich. I hate it when stuff I don't care about becomes a political hot button. In this case, whether or not homosexuals should be allowed to marry. It's fine with me, as long as they don't register someplace pricey.
And that was the line that got a lot of reaction from
readers.
Oh,
yeah, it did. I heard a lot from people who, you know, told me straight up that they were gay and that they liked this kind of humor about themselves because it kind of let them in, you know, when you could joke about what you are. And a lot of them, at least the ones that I heard from, had a very self-deprecating sense of humor about themselves or their situation. But one thing they didn't have a sense of humor about was the law trying to marginalize them. And I happen to agree with that, so I wrote the column. Mm.
Decade later, gay marriage is legal in Utah.
Yeah.
Have your thoughts changed at all on it?
Not a bit. I mean, I'm actually a licensed minister. I became a minister so that I could marry one of our coworkers and his fiance. Since then, I've had two offers to marry perform a ceremony for gay people who want to get married. We're trying to work out the logistics on that. I'm not sure how my bishop will take that, but hey, if you're going to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read his columns at sltrib.com and hear him unplugged each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support by Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. See you next time.